Okay, I think we'll kick off again. We're going to start with Matt Huddleston from the Hadley Centre at the Met Office, going to talk about the weather this summer, but taking a slightly longer view, just looking at recent trends as well, before we move over to Alan from GRID.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back here at the Outlook briefing. So many thanks to Ofgem for inviting the Met Office to speak. It's, I don't know, probably the sixth or seventh one I've done, often with James. And the others have been through the winter, though, and there is always this question, as we've presented about climate change, global warming, as to whether there would be really increased stresses on the system in the summer. So we're going to cover some of those topics off and to give some context to the summer outlook. Also the emerging role of the Met Office and its role within the energy industry in working with Ofgem and a number of you in trying to manage the changing climate and your risks from weather impacts. So the Met Office, we're down in Exeter nowadays, and we provide the National Weather Service, and the information that I'll be providing to you today is as part of that. It's now a rolling program of emergency response. We sit on COBRA even in the Cabinet Office, and it means that when very dire events happen, as did last summer, that you're getting the best advice. And we do provide a range of services to the commercial world, and perhaps those are much less well known. And that includes providing half the world's airline forecasts. So if you ever fly in Europe or Asia, you'll be getting forecasts for the flight from the Met Office. We have the National Climate Research Centre, the Hadley Centre for Climate Change at the Met Office as well. And that is something that started with Margaret Thatcher some time ago now and has been underpinning research in climate change and advising the international community. And that has led to trying to understand the impact of climate change, not just on UK, but globally in terms of economics. And so the kind of risk-based analysis of weather and climate that Nicholas Stern took into his review came from the Hadley Centre, and that has enabled us to understand that acting now is going to be much cheaper than delaying and trying to manage the impact of climate change later. Also, I'll mention a little bit later on some of the work we're doing with the energy industry. I think just about every major player in energy in the UK is working with us to try and manage their weather and climate risks. Now, if we look at weather forecasting, it has changed dramatically. So, of course, everybody talks about the 1987 storm, although, you know, it was 20 years ago. And you know, the accuracy of weather forecasts is such that a forecast for 3 days ahead is now as accurate as a forecast 1 day ahead was 20 years ago. So you can see a huge increase in the accuracy. And I don't get ripped down the pub half as much as I used to, but still people bring it up. Now, so people know about that side of weather forecasting. Now, if you go to longer range, as we're talking about today, if you start to talking about the weeks and months ahead, it enables people to take action in managing their resources, managing all sorts of disruption and standby preparations. But the nature of the science is that it becomes much more about managing your risks. We can't say exactly what will happen a few more than a week ahead. Sometimes even that is a very big challenge. But when you're looking 2 weeks ahead, then you're talking about managing the probabilities and risks of different events. And that's a change in thinking. So for energy companies, they're having to re-engineer their whole energy demand models to take risk-based information. And I think on every time scale, on every type of environmental variable we can predict, we're looking at forecast of probabilities, forecast of risks. And that's what we're trying to communicate to our just, not just our public customers, but to our commercial ones as well. So this is where we're at today. We're talking about seasonal forecasts. They didn't exist a few years ago, and actually when we put the first one out for a cold winter in 2005, many of our colleagues in Europe thought we were barking mad, to be honest. Now, that's because it's an inherently difficult thing to do. Where we are in the world, it's a very noisy place in terms of planetary weather. There's other parts of the world that are much more predictable in terms of what will happen 3 or 6 months ahead. Nevertheless, our forecasts have been given generally good advice. They are broad brush and large scale. They do not give the granularity of information that you would like. We understand that, and we are gradually improving our understanding to hopefully to give you more detail and understanding. So they can be used in some ways and give good advice, but not perhaps if you're trying to plan when to have your children's barbecue outside or something. In terms of longer range information, then we're being pushed on a daily basis with this, and it's in the press a lot. It has been this year. Has global warming finished? And has it ended? Because there's been a cool signal in the global climate this year and last year, and that certainly it certainly has not. And we understand very well what's going on in the climate at the moment. And what we have is the first forecasting system that looks out for over the next decade. It's been developed in the Hadley Centre using science that was used to predict global warming. And that predicted last year when we released this forecast that the last year and this year would be cool, and then after 2009, half the years would be warmer than the warmest year on record, which was 1998 when there was a big El Nino. So in terms of global temperature then, this is observations. This is not in debate. This is just a record of actually what's happened in terms of global temperature. With any good science, it's got error bars on it. And it's a ranked diagram. So on the bottom, you have a rank of 50 of the warmest 150. In the inset diagram, you can see all the 150 years going back to 1860. And you can see if you just rank them in terms of temperature, and then you can color code them by when those years were, they're all the recent years are bunched up to the left. So you have the 11 of the 12 warmest years happening in the last 12. So that is the underlying climate trend. Now, of course, you're going to get natural variability around that, and it's not every year is going to be warmer than the last. That's clearly not going to happen. But that's just observations. So I'm not talking about whether global warming is happening or not. Another set of observations is this, and this is the one that I think really sticks in the throat a bit. This is global carbon emissions year by year from 1990 to 2010. And you can see it's going from about 6 up to about 8, round about now. And the black and white dots is what has actually happened. They're just observations. And you can see the coloured lines then, it doesn't matter what the numbers are, but they're all of the international scenarios of what might happen with global warming. And right now, they're at or below observations. So that means carbon emissions are higher than all the scenarios that have been used within the international community for looking at climate change. Now, that might be just an annual blip. Maybe this year it will drop again. But we don't see the amount of energy being used dropping. So and we haven't seen carbon capture and storage coming online quickly to get those emissions down. So that's the picture as it stands right now. And if we look at the impact on global temperatures, now, this is a graph 1900 to 2100, 200 years. So the first 100 years, you have a black line in the middle, that's what's really happened, that's the observations. And then you can see a little spike in 2003 with a star on it. And that was that really warm summer. I remember swimming in the Mediterranean that year, and the Med can be quite cold, and it was very warm that year. And that star was very unusual, about a 1 in 500 year event. Very, very unusual indeed. But if you look at this graph, and if you believe the upward trend of the lines going forward, by about 2040, that would happen by every other year. So there's different things to take from this graph. Now, the observed line, the black line, that's actually what's happened. And all the others are wiggles. Those are just models. They're climate models. They're not like economic or energy models because they're based on the laws of physics. Okay, so but all those wiggles are what you get if you put a fluid on a rotating sphere and put a heat source on it. And that's what you get. And that's just normal interannual variability. And so we expect some years to be colder than others. And we expect some to be much warmer than others, but those are the extremes. We don't expect massive changes in the frequency of events. So what we're talking about is a large change in what you call return periods. So if by 2040, this event is going from 1 in 500 years to 1 in 2. It's a very big change. And then by 2060, then you're looking at that being a cool summer. Now, if you're a hotelier down in Devon, where we are, they're probably rubbing their hands with glee. Yeah. But for the energy industry, it will start to have a bigger impact. And we see countries that have very hot summers, and brownouts in California or in Chicago. And in 2006, when we had a similarly warm event in Europe, we had a brownout in London, and energy spikes that year. And now I know that was because of, let's say, other circumstances, perhaps bad maintenance scheduling. But those all fall into the mix. And as we saw with the flooding last year, it's the overall impact of society from a single event that can really cause the problems. When you have the substations, panicked people around substations trying to stop them flooding because GCHQ is going to go down if they flood and such like. So it's those wider scale impacts that are not very predictable. So the message from this, the trend is there. It's an underlying trend in global warming, and there's natural climate variability on top. So what about the forecast for this year? So this is the headline map, and it's a rainfall map. Now, as I say, it doesn't normally, to the energy industry, you're more interested in temperature. It's a bigger driver of energy demand. But if like last year, you're talking about the extreme amounts of rainfall, it can be an issue. This, where you see the green patch in the middle, that means perhaps average or wetter than average. And the red patch at the bottom, southern Europe, this means more likely drier than normal. So this is a rainfall map. And we're talking above or below normal. We're not talking about extremes. The chances of getting another summer like last year are extremely, extremely low. We're not expecting that to happen. Last summer was an event that was primarily natural variability, as far as we know, not driven by climate change, although there are aspects of it that perhaps were, including the intensity of the rainfall, how heavy it rained. But for this year, we're expecting the signal that we might get more changeable weather coming through the UK and Northwest Europe. And in southern Europe and eastern Europe, a drier scenario. And there's not a lot of agreement in terms of global warming, what will happen to the summers in terms of rainfall. But if there is an emerging pattern, it actually looks pretty much like this. If we're looking at temperatures, then we're looking for a summer that will be warmer than average, and with spells of wetter and cloudier weather. And rainfall more likely to be near average or above average, as I've mentioned. And this risk of exceptional rainfall, it's there, but it's very minimal indeed, and we don't expect to repeat. That doesn't mean it won't happen, of course. If we look at a typical British summer, and in terms of probabilities and risks, then you've got a normal bell curve of probabilities. So when you're talking average, that's the peak of probability. And what we're talking about change then for this summer is just a push to the right of that bell curve. Now, if you've got a sensitivity on the right-hand side, perhaps where that little tick mark is, to a certain extreme weather, you can see there's a lot more area under that curve. So if you're, say, in the railways and your rail lines buckle at a certain temperature, or your transmission cables are sensitive to a certain temperature, you can see the chances of more extreme episodes are there just because we've moved the bell curve to the right. So there is a higher chance of extreme weather just because you change the mean. And that's just not rocket science, as it were. That's just what happens when you change the prediction. Just to give you some confidence in these seasonal forecasts, I use a lot of different sources of information. We do use weather models, climate models, based on the laws of physics, that are kicked off with analysis of the here and now. Now cast using observations. They are useful in some circumstances and not very useful in others. So we need some skill. We look in the past performance. We look how good they are. We use statistical models. If it's El Nino or a La Nina in the Pacific, how does that impact our weather in the UK? We look at research studies on those sort of phenomena as well. Forecasts from other centres. And ocean temperature has a big impact on UK climate, so we need to know the ocean temperature. Climate trends, that underlying trend line, means that if you're just using 61 to 90 data, then you're always going to look warm, for instance. So you have to take those into account. And so you need to be able to bring that all together, and I think that's something that pretty unique, is to be able to bring that together in a quantitative way, not just a hand-waving argument, but some analysis. So I'll show you a forecast a bit like that a bit later. Now, so we released this forecast a few weeks ago now, and at Science Media Center we had a press briefing, and I think we really looked very upfront about the limitations of this science now, because we've seen it being on the front pages of the newspapers quite frequently when we put out a winter forecast, and we want to be very clear about what you can and can't use it for. So there are limitations. It is a developing science. It's a bit like where weather forecasting was 20 years ago, and extremes are not well defined, but it does give useful advice to some customers. It's useful for utility companies like yourselves to get an overview of the whole season, for infrastructure, for contingency community, and for, it actually moves the market. So there is some useful information in those terms. It's not useful for you and me as individuals for planning anything in particular about our lives, to be honest. It's not useful for planning specific days or identifying extremes or when extremes will happen. So just a reminder then, we're talking average or certainly cooler than 2003 and 2006, and more rainfall than normal. In terms of the energy industry and using these forecasts, then there's forecasts available on different time scales, and these are sort of things that are much more useful for risk managers. People are used to using a lot of information in terms of probabilities and such. So this is a tool looking over the next month, the next 1 month time scale, as to the impacts of weather and certain weather regimes. So you can see in this map a certain likelihood of rain over the UK and cool temperatures. So there's these sort of products that are available if you're feeling very exposed to certain climate events. This is a forecast we did for last summer, and it shows the probabilities in actual absolute temperatures, not just above and below average. You can see in the light blue, that's what's normal. So you can see a nice kind of bell curve. This is what's normal. Everything from 1972 being quite cool and normal up to 2003, 2006 being very warm and normal. But you can see that last year, the probabilities were stacked to the right, and it actually outturned in this bar here, 14.1 degrees C for last summer, even though it was very wet and cloudy and it felt cold. It was still average temperature. It wasn't colder than normal, so which is pretty surprising when you consider the conditions. We're working very closely with a large number of the energy industry on the impact of climate change. It's not just about reducing carbon, but it's how will that changing climate really impact infrastructure, energy demand, seasonality, infrastructure, tables and such like. And so we're working very closely to try and take this science and not make it just policy relevant, but relevant to users so that they can make decisions on a daily basis. And so that work will conclude in the next month, and I guess some aspects of it will be made public, so do watch out for that. There'll certainly be some publicity around that. Something we did last year, and certainly worked very closely with EDF on this one, which was to quite quickly get a better idea of what's expected for this year and the coming years. Because if you're making your decisions about weather from the last 50 years, so if you're using the last 50 years of information, the middle of that period, you know, it might be the 1980s. Now the climate has warmed significantly since the 1980s, and so you actually want an idea of what the weather is for this year, the normal, the climate normal. So using some of our decadal forecasting technology and our observations, we put together what's expected as a baseline climate for the coming years. So that's helping them to manage energy demand and such. So I'll leave it there.
Thanks very much. Over to Alan from Grids.